Well, we are continuing our conversation with Bill Pritchard at Vancouver City College, where he has returned for a short holiday, and we are taking advantage of his holidaying to get some reminiscing about the Winnipeg General Strike, of which he is, as far as the leadership is concerned, the last living survivor. His chief fame from the Winnipeg General Strike arises from his address to the jury, an address which took 2 days to deliver, and which has been characterized as probably one of the finest addresses ever made in Canadian history. And one of the things that we feel good about in issuing this book, Winnipeg 1919, is that we have rescued this speech from near oblivion, and the publication of this book, which you see in front of us, assures that William Pritchard's speech will become a part of Canadian history. Now, I have, and I want to question him about that address and about the background to that address. I have here the news item of from the Winnipeg Tribune, dated March the 23rd, 1920, reporting on the first day when Pritchard took the stand and addressed the jury in his own defense. And I want to read the impression that this made on one of the reporters that was there. He says, "The Vancouver labor leader, in addition to being the most brilliant of the galaxy of star orators who have so far addressed the jury, displays a knowledge of the other cultural arts that would astonish the average individual whose mental picture of a labor leader is a horny-handed, unread, ungrammatical toiler. Mr. Pritchard's address is an intellectual treat to the best educated in the courtroom." And I say A to that. Now, how did you come to decide to plead in your own behalf?
Well, we met along with Mr. Bonner. Remember. And he made the suggestion that some of us should defend ourselves. So Ivan insisted that he should, and he did. Then they took John Queen, very good choice too. Then your humble servant.
So it was a decision among you that you should...
Then we could split our forces, and if one made a motion, the rest would join in that particular motion, and we could all talk to it, you see. And the first motion in the court was a change of venue. Then there was the motion that the judge should disqualify himself because the evidence evidently would be of the same type as the evidence in the Russell case, and he was the judge in that case. And he would now be sitting as trial judge in a case in which he had already had the evidence. And a peculiar thing about that trial was that this gentleman was writing his speech to the jury about halfway through the trial. He claimed that he was doing his best to get rid of any impressions he had from the previous trial and made various other excuses. Well, that went by the board. And a number of motions were made, and we joined in these motions. We even suggested that with a panel so huge, 250, some about that, that we'd take the first 12 names out of the hat. Well, this is not, to use the words of Brother Nixon, constitutionally appropriate. You can't do that. So we had to take what we got. And what we did get was very good. But they were all farmers. To sit upon a trial that was a matter of an industrial dispute. And all of these farmers had suffered somewhat. You know, they couldn't send their milk to the market or whatever it was.
Incidentally, in regard to that point,
So that's how we came to put up our own defense.
How did you prepare your speech?
I beg pardon?
How did you prepare your speech?
From notes I took from the evidence, from gathering, and I took time out from the trial to go upstairs into the law library, and I assembled the documents and numbered them that I wanted to use, the exhibits. They allowed those. They trusted me with those.
Well, were you...
Now, a minute. That's how I prepared the speech. Mm-hmm. And that's all I had with my notes.
You didn't write out the speech?
No. You have a copy here of the only speech in my life that I ever wrote. And that's because I couldn't deliver it in Winnipeg and they needed it, so I wrote it.
That's a different speech than this.
Every speech I ever made in my life, and I made far too many, were all extemporaneous. And this was extemporaneous, just from the notes I had.
Now, the thing that struck this reporter was the intellectual character of your speech. It's full of references to poets, philosophers, economists. And it seems to me, Mr. Pritchard, that you are among the last survivor of a remarkable group of workers that came over from Britain and who did probably more as a group than any others to implant radicalism and socialism in Canada. And they all had that same characteristic of being very well educated, but it must have been self-education.
Yes. With one exception, and that is Armstrong. He was born in Toronto. And his foolishness in being born in Canada prevented us being shipped overseas without any trial. That is what stopped Andrews from his threat in 24 hours on the high seas.
What was it in your background that aroused your interest in this literature and poetry and philosophy and economics? Is that how you came to socialism?
Well, according to my mother, I was a bad boy in this sense that if I could see a book, I would pick it up as a youngster. Without boast, I read the newspaper to my mother when I was 6 years old. I went to school at 2 and a half. And if you want to think of formal education, I didn't have it.
You didn't have any?
I left school before I was 13, and I went to work, and I went to school at night on technical matters. I studied a little German. I learned to type. I learned shorthand. And I didn't learn to talk, but I think I was born that way, you know.
Were you a socialist when you arrived in Canada?
Yes.
How did you become a socialist in Britain?
My father was here in Vancouver, and he would write to me. Now, you were going to ask about him, weren't you?
Yes. There is a reference in your speech to the fact that he was almost killed in a coal mine explosion 2 years before you were born.
The Clifton Hall explosion.
Was he a socialist?
Not when he left England. When he got here into the coal mines on Vancouver Island, with Parker Williams, if you remember Parker Williams, and a fellow named Mottishaw, the three of them organized the coal camps of Vancouver Island and tied them up to the Western Federation of Miners. The Dunsmuir interests were powerful then.